And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach as we listen to the Cats Dancing on Snare Drums from Houston. Isn't that what it is? Something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah, okay. And the telephone numbers to call in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Anywhere else within the sound of his voice.
Or yours, for that matter.
I don't know.
Who matters anyway?
Yeah, that's right. It's well.
You
matter.
Wanted to talk about stocks. You said we didn't get to talk about stocks. Well, let's tell us. I mean, this is Jeff and Jake McClure. We're the Personal Wealth Coach. We're going to.
Actually, you're only Jake McClure. I'm Jeff McClure.
But I'm.
You said
Jake McClure.
Good. Good. I'm glad we got that straight.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure you weren't saying that you were. Me or
no,
I
no,
was you.
No,
we
no,
don't
I'm,
want any of that.
We have this identity thing that we could get into very, very easy. And the telephone number is to call in here 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And so the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down just a little bit. I like that. For the week, it was down. Year-to-date, it's up about 15%. For the week, it was down about 1.17%. It closed out at 15,070. And, of course, everybody's very disappointed because it was down 1.17%. I say everybody, but there was a lot of gloom and doom about that. But, folks, it's over 15,000. I'm happy. The S&P 500 was down about 1% for the week. Year-to-date, it's up about 14%. And that's the way it goes out there in the big world. There's a couple of interesting articles to do with stocks that I think are very important that I read today in Barron's and other places. And that is the greed factor. And we've seen this, too. It started to abate a little bit as the market has started back. As the market has gone down 3 of the last 4 weeks a little. But there's a greed factor out there. And we it seems like we alternate between fear and greed. And in 2009 time frame, plus or minus a few years, we had to, in our business and anyone who's in the business of trying to manage investments for people, has had to deal with a fear factor where people want to get out of the market because the market is down or the market is, quote, going down, end quote. And we tell people, no, 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 don't do that. Stay invested. Stay in an appropriately balanced position. And by the way, I'm at this point contacting people who got out when the market went down. And despite the fact that the market is up like 100% from where it was at the bottom, still have not gotten back in. They're waiting for the market to be going up, I guess. But the backside to that is beginning to show up again now too, which is greed. And I've said this to a lot of people. If your portfolio so far this year has risen as much as the S&P 500, you have a lot to fear. Because the S&P 500 has run up a whole bunch this year, and if the only place you're going to get that is in something that looks like 100% stock portfolio in the S&P 500, because the rest of the market didn't. Now, for example, last year we had some pretty good returns in diversified emerging market. This year they're down a couple of percent. Last year, domestic markets didn't do all that well, domestic stock markets. But this year, they're up a whole bunch. And that is part of asset allocation, and it's a critical part of having a good portfolio, is not chasing whatever piece of the market just went up, but holding to a good, well-defined plan of some kind. It's just like right now, because we've been talking about the dangers in long-term bonds, and there are some big dangers in long-term bonds, people are saying, why should we have bonds at all? Well, you should have bonds at all not to make money, but to avoid losing money. We typically keep some short bond positions, I say short-term meaning bond positions in portfolios, because bad things can happen and we have to have some place to turn to in an emergency when you need money. But your track as you move forward, and I'm really pleased to see that actually come out. It was in the journal, that other advisors and investment counselors and things of that nature are saying the same thing that we are, which is that you should have a long-term rate of return goal. That should be your benchmark. If it's 8%, fine, 8%. If it's 5%, that's fine too. If it's 10%, okay, shoot for 10% and recognize you're going to have a really, 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 really bumpy ride. But the point is, don't measure your portfolio's performance against an index. Indexes can go crazy in both directions. Any index can. And there's a lot of danger in trying to chase an index. And we still have a few people who, when the S&P 500 goes up, want to be fully invested in the S&P 500 after it's gone up, which is a really good way to lose a lot of money. The buy high, sell low mentality apparently is working very well, because a little earlier in the year, interest rates dropped a little bit, and bonds went up a little bit. High yield went up a little bit. Record quantities of money early this year went into those bond mutual funds. In the last month or so, as interest rates have risen and they began to fall, guess what happened? Record quantities of money began to come out. Well, that's not coincidental, by the way. A lot of money going into something causes it to go up in value. A lot of money coming out causes it to go down in value. But as the bond market has begun to descend, money has been rushing out of it. In other words, people have been doing a really classic job of buying high and selling low in a very short period of time in the bond market, which is about as, I don't know, it's one of those things that's fairly simple to understand. But because we had the 10-year Treasury, for example, which was running around 1.5%, a little over 1.5%, 1.6%, it jumped up over 2% for a short period of time. That's a heck of a rise. That is a, it's only 0.5% difference. But that 0.5% represented a 1/3 increase in interest rates. And people bailed. It's astonishing. And as interest rates come down and the market goes up, people jump in. And there were several organizations that did a little tracking during that period and said, whoever it is that's jumping in and out is losing money hand over fist. You know, and it's a matter of there's two things really important that I'm trying to say so far this hour. One is, you can't depend on somebody else to take care of your retirement. You got to be investing. And people that are investing are often not investing enough. The second thing is that your investing needs to be oriented on a strategy that makes sense over the long term. And it needs to be balanced, and it needs to be consistent. And it needs, again, critical that it makes sense over the long term, which means you need to educate yourself or else hire somebody. That was my soapbox for today.
Well, very good. Your feet, if you were on the soapbox, your feet should be clean.
That's right. And so you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And you're certainly welcome to give us a call.
Yes. Let me...
Fewer people are asking for unemployment. Did you know that?
I did notice that. This is one of the things that I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
Our unemployment rate is a shifty little thing in that our... What is our unemployment rate now? About 7.6?
7.7. It rose up to 7.7.
Okay, 7.7. At the depths of the recession, it was right around 10. However, so it looks like we've had this great recovery in the unemployment. However, it's not the case, because we've lost about 2% of the workforce to attrition. They just decided not to go back to work.
We got to find that attrition.
Where is attrition, and that, where are they?
If we lost it to attrition.
Yes, attrition, give them back.
Yes.
So what we have a little bit less unemployment than we had then. We have been making enough jobs to hire the new people that are coming into the workforce and to hire some of the people that were unemployed, but not a lot of them. So this goes back to us last hour saying that our economy, while it is stronger than Europe's by far, is stronger than Japan's by far, we're still sick. We still have issues. And to say that the government should be cutting jobs at a time when we are not doing well is probably not a good idea. I realize that a lot of people think that, well, you shouldn't go into debt if you are not making as much money, unless you're investing that money into things that will cause you to make more money down the road. That's true. Unless you're having trouble eating, and then you should probably go into debt to eat. And that's where we are right now. We've got an issue, and this is one this is my soapbox. The left side of the political spectrum has a school of economics that they purport to follow, and the right side of the political spectrum has a school of economics that they purport to follow. And notice I said purport, because the schools that they're talking about, and they've got all kinds of different names, but one basically is Keynesian, the other one is Friedman. The two opposing sides, where Friedman says the government shouldn't be involved, and Keynes said the government should be involved in everything, only neither of them said that.
Recently I've read that they basically say the Keynesians are on one side and the Austrians are on the
other. There you go, the Austrians. And Austrians, Friedman was an Austrian, not as a nationality, but he liked the Austrian school of economics. The issue here is that the Austrian school is very clear that the government should be involved in downturns in the economy. There's no quibble about that. You talk to an economist that has any knowledge on Austrian school, and you'll hear them say that. However, if you talk to a congressional representative that purports to follow the Austrian school, that's usually going to be a Republican, they're going to say the government should never be involved in anything. Then you have the Keynesian side, which is the opposite of that, that the Democrats purport to follow, that they say that the government should spend because it causes the economy to grow. Except that Keynes said that the government should have a balanced budget. The only years it shouldn't have a balanced budget are in years of recession. And then when we had good growth going, we should pay back and have a balanced budget at the end of that. So
you mean like we were looking at in 2000 before we cut taxes?
Right, except that now we have a bunch of people that think that the economists are telling them, you know, they think that they're working on some strong economic principle that the government should either not be involved at all or should be involved in everything. And that's a problem. It's a very real problem in that, well, I think it's true in most cases, people hear what they want to hear. And if we're looking at the economic principles here, cutting the government at this point is not a good idea in either of those schools. We do need to cut the government, but doing it right now is really silly. We're at a point where unemployment's already a problem. We have people leaving the workforce, that we're creating value for our economy. And the government's cutting even more. When they're making it harder for the people that are in the private sector, that have been in the private sector the whole time, that are looking for jobs, they're making it harder for them to find a job by putting a bunch of other people into the unemployment force looking to find a job, when that's a completely artificial cut. And anyway, that was my soapbox. It wasn't quite as long as yours. I don't think I have as much wind in me.
For whatever it's worth, what I'm looking at in the economy right now, for anyone who cares to listen to this too much, is sometime next year we will see the economy begin to stabilize and return to what economists would call a normal condition, where the Federal Reserve does not have to continue to pump money into it to keep it going. I think I'm pretty confident we're going to see that next year.
Well, I can give you some points on that, very clear ones.
All right.
There are some, for lack of a better word, some building blocks that are out there for, and I'm going to use a specific case, housing market. These are things that when I mention them, people ask me, are we at the bottom of the housing market? What's going on there? We've got a really good environment for housing. We've got low mortgage rates. People go, yes, I knew about that. We've got bank lending standards are easing. People are getting loans easier. People have heard about that as well. Household formations. We're getting into economic speech here. What that means is that young people are leaving the houses of their parents again. during the recession and all the way up through 2011, people were moving back in with their parents. Now they're moving out. When households form, we use up that excess supply. Those empty houses start getting filled up, which means that it's harder to find a house. House prices are rising. That's a symptom, not really the building blocks. But the affordability of those houses is still at a record low level. It's very easy to afford a house because when people generally buy a house, they're not thinking the sticker price, they're thinking the monthly price. And with the interest rates as low as they are, a monthly price in a house is, right now is lower than has ever been seen as a proportion of income. We've got a record low for new home inventories. This is one of the things that we've been looking at, old Baldy and I. We look at this over a long period of time. New houses, we had a huge glut of new house supply. The people, the builders were overbuilding, and they were building all the way through 2008 and into 2009 when it was obvious they shouldn't be. Well, now we're 4 years later, and there's been almost no new house building during that time as a proportion. So starts and permits on new house building are at record low as well, which means existing house prices are going to go up. And eventually,
yeah, and I think,
and declining mortgage delinquencies and foreclosures is the last part of that.
I think you'll start to see that improve. And around 2016, I think we'll probably be hitting on all cylinders and everything will be running along nicely, which, by the way, infuriates certain people.
Yes, they don't want that to be because of people. This is one of the
presidential election coming up.
When we give the blame or the credit for our economic condition to the president,
we make an error.
That's a massive error. The president has very little to do with it. Congress has more to do with it, but even they have little to do with it.
But factually, we tend to reelect the party if it in power. If the economy is doing well,
it's the economy stupid, right? Yes. It's irrelevant to the reality of the situation, but it makes us feel good.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. My name is Joel. Live here in Temple, and you were talking about it easier to get money.
It's less expensive to get money.
I mean,
it's not easier.
I mean, you know, like to refinance a house get a house.
It is. The bank lending standards are getting a little bit laxer.
Well,
but
it must not be in my case because I've had an account with a local bank or a national bank for over 10 years, and I was trying to refinance to get my rate down.
Uh-huh.
And they're treating me like I just got out of prison or something.
Yeah.
Was there something
you might want to shop.
Government controls or?
No.
Go ahead and shop. Yeah.
Let me say something here.
Well, I made a mistake, and I gave them some money for the appraisal.
And your appraisal came back low.
No, the appraisal came back great.
Okay.
But, I mean, I've had to jump through hoops and show them.
Well, your appraisal is still good.
You can use that elsewhere.
You know, it's just that, you know, you hate to spend the kind of money to get the appraisal and have people treat you like
now that you've got your appraisal, it's generally good for about 6 months. You might want to shop around, but there is a problem, and the problem is that, and we've been talking about this a lot, this is why we tell people that the Federal Reserve needs to continue to buy bonds, and it is so critical. Banks actually have two problems right now. Number one, their reserves have been devastated by the fact that they held a lot of bonds that became essentially worthless. Now, they're being supported at an artificial level. That's the big thing, by the way, the Fed's bond buying program does, is it keeps mortgage bonds that are held by the banks that were artificially, the banks were artificially allowed to keep those bonds on the books at some very high percentage of their purchase price. They're really in the open market. If the Fed stopped buying, they wouldn't be worth that. This makes the banks very skittish. If the Fed stopped buying bonds, then their reserves would shrink, and they can only make loans to a certain percentage of their reserves. So they're scared. Secondly, as is always happens with regulators, once the horse is out of the barn, man, they want to make sure that that door is padlocked.
Right. They go in there with 2x4s and a nail gun and start closing that thing up.
So you've got banks under the gun, and if there's any slight anything that looks bad, particularly local banks.
Yeah. And even if it doesn't look bad sometimes.
Will really, really, really hesitate to make that loan. And
well, mine's, you know, not really a, I mean, Bank of America is not really a local bank.
Well,
but, no.
No, but they're a bank in trouble if you look it up.
The new regulations that were passed to try to, you know.
Well, Bank of America is a good example. You said the right one. Bank of America, it's a strong bank. But they're under a lot of scrutiny right now. They are not going to be one of the banks that's easing its lending standards. It might be easier for you to go to Citibank or to there are lots and lots and lots of banks out there that are actively looking around. Bank of America, through its choice but under pressure from other people, wound up buying Countrywide, which was the biggest problem bank prior to the recession. They were the ones that were offering the no money down, not only no money down, we'll give you money to come to get a loan from us. And we're still discovering problems with the Countrywide loans. And Bank of America is left holding the bag there. So they have less money to lend, and the scrutiny of the regulators are right over their shoulders right now. They've got them breathing down their necks. So if you just do a shop around, I think you'll find it's a little bit easier now than it was. It's still not anywhere near as easy as it was in 2007 to get a home refinanced. But compared to then, I mean, you didn't have to look for the bank back then. They came knocking on your door and said, hey.
Is your appraisal, do you have 20% equity in the house?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Then there's there may be something in your credit history they don't like or something, but the point is
my credit came back 821.
Well, you're in great shape then.
The fact that they are that way means you need to be looking at other banks.
Yeah, you've got great credit.
Why they were treating me like I just got out of prison or something?
Wait, I've got to ask this: did you just get out of prison?
No.
Okay.
No,
well,
no.
I don't know why.
Your credit limit's pretty low if you just got out of prison.
I don't know.
If you got your bills paid, I think it's fine.
I filled out a lot of
pay your bills.
I filled out a lot of credit applications, and they never asked me if I was in prison. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, well, you usually don't have much history, though, yeah. I would think.
I don't know.
When you put your address down as a penal institution, they might get a suspicion. But other than that, I don't know how they would know on a credit check.
Anyway, I would say if you shopped around, you might find a lot better deal. I just got through refinancing my house, and it went through very smoothly, admittedly. Yeah. I had a very long relationship with a very stable organization. Have you got a military background at all?
No.
Okay, well, I'm just going to make a recommendation.
Well, have you considered joining up?
Well, I'm past the age of what they call it.
Yeah, I figure if you've got an 821.
Anyway, yeah.
Right, if you've got an 821 on your credit score, it's probably a little late for that. But, you know,
the
recruiters are looking, so you might.
And you, the regulators are. As I said, there's two problems there. One is there's a lot of banks that have reserve problems. Bank America is one of them. Mm-hmm. They did not do well on the stress test.
The last
stress test. They basically said if we had a worst-case economic collapse, by the way, that means that the euro suddenly ceases to exist, Bank of America would be in deep trouble. Therefore, making more loans means taking on more risk, so they're probably not going to want to take on more risk. If you go to a bank that came through with flying colors on the stress test, then you may find it's easier to get a loan from them. And so it's a different, as you probably have figured out, we are in a different world now than we were before the collapse.
Yeah.
It just seems funny, you know, people with no problems on their history that still have trouble, you know. And you know, they're asking you questions. Well, wait a minute, you've got my loan already. Shouldn't you know that? You know, shouldn't you already know the answer to that question?
Well, you're basically lining out one of the reasons that we're in business is because we actually do know the people who call us on the phone.
Yeah.
And again, that's where you can. It's sometimes good to go through some organization, and I'm not going to name any, but there's nationwide organizations that really don't actually loan you the money, but they act as a broker to find somebody to loan you the money. And you can find them online, and they have big websites, and that sounds a little impersonal. On the other hand, very frankly, you might even try the local banking system and see what they'll do for you. I don't know. I've not had a lot of good experience with asking people to do that because they've come back to me and said, no, they said they wouldn't do it either.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of the online folks who will probably be thrilled to have you.
So how long do you say the appraisals are usually good for?
My experience, and I'm not a real estate expert here, but my experience is they're generally at least good for 6 months.
Okay.
And you've already got an appraisal, and if you can put the bank that you're talking to in contact with the people who did the appraisal, then they probably will be able to get on that fairly quickly.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks
for
the call.
And you have a good day. Bye-bye. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Numbers to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we're going to do some commercials here. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. All I could imagine in listening to that thing I just heard was tipping cows.
Flipping houses and tipping cows.
Call us for your tipping cow formula.
I've got it free. Yes, I've got it free for a limited time. I will give you my tipping of cows formula.
Your cow tipping formula?
Yes.
And it's free?
Yes, for a limited time.
For a limited time. Can you flip houses, though? I mean, there was a tornado went through that flipped some houses.
I can leap houses.
With a single bound?
With a single bound, yes.
I never actually have seen you do that.
Well, I did several times as a child using sheets as parachutes. I leapt down from houses in a single bound and hurt myself a couple of times.
Well, as we've often said, we don't have any control over the commercials that show up. And Lynn, if you're listening, Lynn Willie gets very upset when we say that we don't support commercials.
We
like
don't
that.
Endorse that
but
commercial.
We do not.
Certainly.
We certainly do not endorse the house flipping commercial in any form or fashion. But I will endorse a couple of things here. By the way, you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
I've actually known, by the way, some people who tried flipping houses and they flipped out at all the money they lost. But that's beside the point. There's a couple of things. I'm not saying this on my own. I'm endorsing something in the Wall Street Journal, although I actually would say it on my own, which kind of defeats what I'm about to say. In Wall Street Journal, the Intelligent Investor today, why the market's latest stumbles are good news. There's another article in Barron's about why the recent sell-off in emerging markets is a wonderful thing. In both cases, they're saying the same thing. And that is that something we've noticed. I was looking at it yesterday. The forward price to earnings ratio, which is an indication of how expensive the market is, whether it is fairly priced, underpriced, or overpriced. On the S&P 500, it's like 12.9, and it's been down as low as 10. We've actually seen it lower than that. But the long term average is around 17, which means that the stock market for a long-term investor in the United States is still undervalued. And it got a bit more undervalued over the past several weeks, which is good. At the same time, Chairman Bernanke's comment, which, by the way, was taken completely out of context, he was asked a question, when could the Federal Reserve start tapering off its buying? And they said, well, we could at any time. And then he was asked, could you as early as the next meeting? He said, well, it's always possible depending on what the economy does. Well, the economy has shown no evidence that they need to, but people are still spooked and afraid of it, and people sold out of emerging markets. I'm not suggesting you jump into emerging markets. What I am suggesting is that if you have been holding off investing, thinking the bottom was going to fall out, you're probably a little late to the game, because the bottom fell out in 2009 and has been building back in. But B, it is not too late to start investing. It is not too late to get, if you're a long-term investor, to get back in. The markets are still cheap compared with their historic norms, and they do have this terribly consistent habit of going back to their norms.
Yes, and here you we oftentimes give earnings and forward-looking price-to-earnings ratios for the stock market and such. Those of you that have been listening for long enough know that we often also refer back to the Fed model. Do you want to explain what the Fed model is?
Well, you're talking about the
it's basically the
Yardini's model,
right,
of if whatever the 10-year Treasury earning is.
Yes.
The interest rate on the 10-year Treasury versus the earnings rate on the S&P 500.
Correct. Right? And basically what it's doing is it's saying if you can make, with relatively no risk, a certain amount of money over a 10-year period, it should equate to about a 1-year earning in stock, because mm-hmm. you have more earnings there. You have more risk involved. So looking at that, the Federal Reserve has talked about their model in the past. Yardini has written research papers on it. Ned Davis is another economist that's written research papers on it. And they've come to the same conclusion, and this is what the Fed model is. It's a relatively simple thing. According to the Fed model, right now, we're cheaper than we were at the bottom of the market,
right,
in 2009.
And by that, we mean, when we look at the price-to-earnings ratio, if you reverse that, so let's say it's 12.9, it's 13. What that means is the price of the New York stock, of a share in, not New York stock, of the S&P 500, if you could buy one share of the S&P 500, which you can't, but it's a model, is priced at 13 times. I don't know what the inverse of that is in actual percentages. You could probably figure it real quickly. But that's probably about an 8% yield on earnings on the S&P 500. It's about 7.5%, 8% yield on the S&P 500 on earnings. So if the yield, if the earnings yield on the S&P 500 is higher than the interest rate on a 10-year Treasury, you should be buying stocks.
Right. So
if it's lower, you should not be buying stocks.
Right. And the 10-year Treasury yield is between 1.8 and 2% at this point at any given fluctuation.
But so, again, this, I want to emphasize, this is in all these things we're saying are long term. And if you're a long term investor, then you buy something that's inexpensive and you ride the value up, and at some point down the road, of course, you're going to want to begin selling to capture that return. If you're a short-term investor, then you're not an investor, you're a speculator, and that's the stuff that makes the news. That's the market going up and down from day to day. And like I said earlier, the issue right now is people are, the greed factor is jumping on board, and they want to jump on something that's going up in a hurry. Only it isn't going up, it just has gone up.
Right.
And it's important, though, that you keep investing, you have a good, clear vision of an understanding of the rate of return you need to get. And let's just give you an example. Let's say that over the last 12 months you've gotten a 15% return, which is really not very much. It's possible that you could have gotten more. Of course, it's possible you could have gotten less. But let's say your long-term goal is 8%. You need to get an 8% return to get where you're going. Well, you've gotten 15 over the last 12 months. This is not the time to get greedy.
No, no.
This is the time to say, wow, that's good. I've gotten like twice the return over the last 12 mm-hmm. months that I really need to get, so I need to hold to this course.
Yeah, one of the other aspects of the economy that's looking up, we've been talking about this for several years, the demand for vehicles, for cars, for trucks, for vans, for and other large durable items is growing quickly. And the reason is, if you think back, when did the recession start? It started in 2008. Most people put off buying a new car. It's now been 5 years. People, and there's a really nice, easy way of looking at graphs of this, basically replacement demand on a vehicle says that we should be selling in the United States about 14 million vehicles a year. That's the replacement demand. Well, in 2009, about 8 million were sold, so about half of what was needed. In 2010, about 10 million. In 2011, about 10 million. We've just gotten to the point right now, April, where for the expectations for the year, about 14.8 million vehicles will be sold this year. That's the expectation, which is great for the vehicle industry because they're looking around and they're saying, we haven't been selling for 5 years. However, it's only replacement for this year. We still have 5 years of replacement. We have a pent-up demand where several years worth of vehicles need to be purchased on top of the current replacement for us to catch up to where we should be.
You're purchasing vehicles on top of vehicles?
Yes, and those you can see them on trucks as they drive down the highway.
Okay,
you see them all stacked on those trucks. That's vehicles on top of vehicles.
Abby Joseph Cohen was making an interesting point about investing in Europe. She says Europe is in bad shape and going downhill. However, she said there was a company that she recommended. I'm not going to give the name, but I thought it was interesting, her thought process. There's only one company in Europe, apparently, that manufactures the underlying product from which tires are made.
Really?
The polymer in Europe. And approximately 25% of the tires in Europe at this point, she says, have less tread because people have been deferring.
Right. I'll wait to
and
buy
so
those tires.
Since its sales went down, its price went down. And she says, probably a good thing, because when they come up for inspection, they're going to have to get new tires.
Right.
And so the demand is going to be there. And, you know, it may be a couple of years before that happens. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Thank you. In today's market, would it make any difference if your 40% that you have in bonds you just held in cash?
Yeah.
How much?
It'd make a lot of difference.
One of the reasons why cash or bonds should be in a portfolio hasn't a lot to do with the long-held and purported belief that somehow you need a ratio in there. The reality is bonds in a portfolio need to be balancing out the volatility of stocks. You don't necessarily – I mean, income is important, but – what we're trying to do here, at least when we design a portfolio, is look at the volatility that is implicit in stocks and balance it in the opposite direction with bonds.
Yeah.
And cash really doesn't have a lot of volatility either way.
And bonds are not the only asset preservation. And we don't talk about stocks versus bonds as much as we do asset preservation.
Versus appreciation.
Versus asset appreciation. And the asset preservation side, we look at, obviously, we think interest rates are going to be going up in the not too far distant future, so we don't want long-term bonds in there.
No.
But what we look at is, let's go back to the past and see when we had this situation in the past and what held up well. But, and this is what we have to look for as far as asset classes is concerned, if there is a shock to the system, the stock market will drop. What tends to hold up reasonably well on the downside but jump upward if the stock market drops? So that's the essence of looking for this. See, cash won't jump upward. As a matter of fact, let me give you a really bad scenario here that worries me all the time, which is why we don't leave a lot of money in money market funds.
Right.
Money market funds are not FDIC insured.
No, they are not.
And there's a lot of discussion about the fact that we could get a systemic collapse of money market funds and whether or not.
We're not saying that to scare a lot of
no.
people, because in the past when something like that happens, the government has stepped in to help.
But one of the issues in a worst-case scenario, and by worst-case scenario, I mean literally if you could have an asteroid hit the United States or the big one occur in California.
That's pretty bad. Yeah.
Congress decide to shut the government down by not paying its debts. Those would all be about equivalent.
Or Taco Bell stopped selling the Gordita.
Right.
No, that's not.
Well, I don't know. You never can tell about these things. But the point is that if one of those things happen, one of those really bad things happen that is unlikely, then what happens? A, money market funds will take a nosedive. So you can't make any money in a money market fund, but there is a distant possibility of losing money in a money market fund.
Now, let's be very clear on this. It's a very distant possibility,
yeah,
but it exists.
And on the other hand, let's just, and I'm going to use an example here. I'm not recommending people go out and do this. I'm just giving you an example. Let's say you had a short-term Ginnie Mae position government national mortgage association backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government that has a yield to maturity of about 2.5%, and the bottom falls out. What's going to happen to that Ginnie Mae position? It's going to go up.
It's going to be very happy.
People are going to flock to that Ginnie Mae position because they're going to put their money someplace where they're confident they're going to get paid back.
Oh, no, very clear here as well. We need to be very careful in our approach to what bonds are in a portfolio.
Right.
But to get rid of them, we were at a conference where Robert Gates was talking, and we had a great deal of conversation with other people. Some of them are very esteemed economists, and some of them are low end on the ethical scale brokers.
You got it. Low end on the ethical scare. Yeah,
yeah.
That was it. Yeah.
And we had a guy sit down at the table with us who, without prompting, started telling us what he was doing as his bond replacement vehicle. And he was using non-traded REITs, which is real estate investment trusts. And he said, we're using these as our bond replacement vehicles. And that, good thing neither of us have hair, otherwise it would have fallen out at that statement. The effort to find a replacement for bonds is going and reaching into weird places. Bonds have a purpose, and as long as you recognize what the purpose is, if you're thinking about replacing bonds with cash, then it's obviously not income that you're using those bonds for. Otherwise, you wouldn't put it in cash either because you're not going to be getting any income there. If you're using it as a balance for volatility, in the off chance that we're completely wrong about the stock market, then you still need bonds. You just have to be very careful because there's a risk there in interest rates. Just watching to make sure you have short maturity
and
very high quality positions.
I'll be very frank and tell you that even with Ginnie Mae's, which we kind of like because we use them, that's only part of our typical asset preservation side of our portfolio. But we've lost money there this year. I mean, you know, they're down a couple of percent this year compared to the beginning of the year. But
that's why I asked the question.
Well, that's supposed to be. That's okay. The stock market went up a whole bunch.
And
so
again,
it's good. It's very acceptable if the stock market goes up a whole bunch to take losses over on the cushion side.
Because it's not there to make big gains, but it is there to not fall a lot and to possibly go up if the stock market crashes.
And so it's, in essence, it's insurance. And just like
so over the long term then,
mm-hmm.
even with the volatility of bonds,
well, we're talking about short duration bonds here.
Yeah, okay. If you got short duration bonds, you're not going to have a whole lot of volatility there.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you go back to the 70s, I mean, bonds were a horrible thing to be in.
Yeah, when inflation was taking off like a rocket ship,
yeah.
If you were in long-term bonds. Again, though, I want to emphasize something. If you had very short duration bonds,
you still got hit, but just not as bad.
No, well, actually, if you held them for a period of time, you probably didn't get hit at all.
Right, and as long as they are high-quality bonds.
You probably didn't keep up with inflation.
Just as a side note, I recently watched with my wife the movie Brewster's Millions, and I don't mean the much older black-and-white version. I mean the Richard Pryor version, where he inherits $300 million, but only if he can spend $30 million in 30 days. And the bank is very keen on keeping the assets, that $30 million, at the bank. So they offer him a 23% a year bank interest rate. And my wife, who's not old enough to remember that, I'm not really old enough to remember it either, except through books, went, what? And so I had to explain it. That was kind of the normal thing at that point. Yes, because inflation was pretty huge.
But you're right. Back then, when interest rates started up, because inflation started up, if you had long-term bonds, you paid a high price for having them.
Yeah.
And I understand in today's environment and stuff that inflation's going to come, but it's not going to be for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you another example. If at the beginning of the 1970s you had bonds, what happened?
Let's see, early 70s. I was overseas. I don't really know what the hell was going on.
Well, from roughly 1970 through the end of 1973, the market fell like a rock. And those bonds rose like a rocket ship.
Yeah. And a lot of times when you see a bond rise like a rocket ship, you're going to see it fall soon afterwards.
But the point is that the reason we want bonds in a portfolio today, and by the way, this is, we don't apply this 100% of the time with 100% of the people because it doesn't apply, but there is a strategy that works very, very well. Have enough money in an asset preservation position that if you need the income or might need the income, you could make it through a typical downturn in the market, which is a couple of years, with no problem, and then have some left over. Have the rest of your money in an appreciation position in a market like this. But you want that money that's in the asset protection side not to just be flat through a market downturn, but to actually rise. Okay? That's it in a nutshell. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've got some commercials to play. Thanks for the call.
And you just learned all about asset allocation in there.
Anyway, at least.
But we're going to do some commercials. We'll be back for just a few minutes on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And listening to the commercials that we're playing just then, I'm wondering, I mean, I'm going to presume that, that whoever did that does market research and determine that the listeners, maybe we're on the wrong station or something. I mean, an interesting little story I wanted to share. And this is Jeff, by the way, and the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We've only got a couple of minutes.
Just a very short period of time.
Hey, I wanted to – egg prices, if you didn't notice, went up 42% last month. If you buy eggs, you'll suddenly notice they jumped in price. And the government – no, actually, if you had been following the news over the last 6 months or so, you would notice there was an outbreak of avian flu in Mexico. Well – avian flu is transmitted by birds. More specifically, chickens are suspected in transmitting. And it was a little minor thing in the papers, if it was even in the papers. I remember seeing it go by in the stuff that I read. Didn't pay much attention to it. But this is how our interconnected world is really interconnected. Jake was saying the same thing happened in China. So basically, because they had to kill off a lot of chickens in Mexico.
And China.
United States egg producers are able to sell their eggs to China and Mexico. By the way, they're flying them to China, which tells you a whole world about our economy.
Yes. Chickens couldn't do it on their own. They're not very good at flying,
jets, yes. You know, and the point is that we are supplying, the United States is supplying eggs to China and Mexico right now, who are willing to pay a lot of money for them. Well, this is another, you know, okay, that's why our egg price went up. But here's the big question. We think of Mexico as being poor. So how are they able to pay that much for eggs? Because their standard of living is going up in Mexico. The standard of living is going up in Mexico because we've actually, that's why one of the reasons there's fewer people coming across the border. That's good. Why? Guess who one of our number one export buyers from the United States is? Mexico. So basically the mere fact that egg prices went up, admittedly, it's a temporary thing. Don't go out and buy egg futures. But it was, you know, obviously the avian flu caused it. But here's the key. In the past, this hasn't happened. Because in Mexico, people would go without eggs rather than paying extra for them.
Right.
Now they're unwilling to go without eggs. Why? Because their standard of living went up, which means that things are getting better, which means that they'll be buying more stuff from us. Fox News Radio
Station in Central Texas. And we'll be back next week
with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.